From Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is the local edition. I'm Jason Dole. Thank you so much for being here with me tonight. I hope you're warm wherever you are, and I hope you made it out of the big winter storm okay. Coming up, as the nation watches federal immigration enforcement in Minneapolis, Hudson Valley community members learn that a local school board member works for ICE. That story is coming right up. Plus, are states spending enough to keep children away from tobacco? The Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids says no. And Spotlight PA reports that Pennsylvania is still waiting for the hundreds of millions of dollars it was promised to expand broadband connectivity. Federal approval has been held up. Why? Because federal officials missed their own deadline to approve Pennsylvania's proposal. Spotlight PA has all the details. We're going to be getting into that. But first, we do start with the latest news from Albany, where Democrats have introduced legislation affecting how New York municipalities can declare a housing emergency. New York Public News Network's Sagina Shrestha has more on how the bill could impact efforts to regulate rent increases.
Under New York's Emergency Tenant Protection Act, municipalities can declare a housing emergency when there's a vacancy rate below 5%. The Rent Emergency Stabilization for Tenants Act seeks to allow communities to declare a housing emergency based on publicly available data and public hearings, avoiding an independent vacancy study. Hudson Valley State Assemblymember Sarahana Shrestha, a Democrat from the 103rd District, says the bill would protect municipalities from litigation.
So we want to remove that hurdle. You know, landlords trying to go after publicly available data and its accuracy is just going to be so much more harder for them that it's not going to be worthwhile.
Opponents say the legislation to make it easier for communities to regulate rent could lead to a decline in housing investment. For the New York Public News Network, I'm Sagina Shrestha.
And we have more news from the legislative session in Albany as Democrats in the New York State Senate advance a series of bills regarding reproductive health care. One measure is up for a vote that would require health insurance plans to cover the cost of freezing someone's eggs. Another bill would require public colleges to have vending machines that dispense emergency contraception. State Senator Shelley Mayer is sponsoring a bill that would let providers dispensing abortion drugs conceal their identities. The Yonkers Democrat says it's a response to red states that have sent subpoenas to doctors in New York.
They are doing everything they can to block what is lawful in New York, which is the prescribing and sending of abortion medication under our SHIELD law, and we have to fight back.
Republicans say these reproductive health care bills are a distraction from improving the state's taxes and cost of living. Abortion rights are enshrined in the New York State Constitution. Well, next month we'll see some big changes to New York State's Department of Motor Vehicles. WSHU's Desiree DiOrio explains.
DMV locations statewide will shut down from February 13 through the 17th while the department rolls out an updated technology system. The shutdown affects all DMV services in person, online, and over the phone. That overhaul comes at the same time as changes to the driver license point system. Starting February 16th, offenses like speeding and leaving the scene of an accident will carry higher point values for longer. That means it'll become easier for the state to suspend driver licenses. On Long Island, I'm Desiree DiOrio for the New York Public News Network.
And now we've got news from the Hudson Valley because as the nation watches and increasingly scrutinizes federal immigration enforcement tactics across the country, especially the protests and the outrage in Minneapolis over public killings of unarmed American citizens, the debate is also playing out closer to home. In Putnam County, some community members are rallying to defend a local school board member who also works for ICE amid criticism and calls for his resignation. WAMC's Lower Hudson Valley Bureau Chief Elias Guerra reports.
The Mayopac Falls Elementary School auditorium was filled with local residents Thursday for the Board of Education meeting. Some were there to call for the removal of one school board trustee, Chris Harrigan, who also works for ICE, specifically enforcement and removal operations. But most of those turned out defended Harrigan. As the Trump administration's aggressive crackdown on immigration continues across the country, Local resident Marie Frankel said she thinks the Democratic Party is behind community pushback on Harrigan's employment with ICE.
Your behavior is appalling, placing images of him on a website saying ICE is evil. It's a threat to our board member and his family. These images should be removed. Perhaps we should place your photos on a website showing your support for illegal aliens over citizens.
While a majority of those who spoke are in support of Harrigan, others want him removed from the school board. Ixmucane Pereira, a Carmel resident, first addressed the board in Spanish.
Uno de sus miembros de la mesa directiva delante de mí se llevó gente, se llevó padres, se llevó...
Pereira said she's opposed to a school board member having access to students' personal information. She tells WAMC she once saw Harrigan with ICE over the summer.
In August, middle of August, a mom called me and she said, there is ICE outside, there is a lot of strange people outside. So I ran and they were looking for someone, a young man. They were like 17 people. They were like 11 cars surrounding two workers. That was my first encounter with Chris Harrigan.
And you recognized him?
Definitely, every time. And many parents told me, he is the man who's in charge of the crew in Pandan County.
Photos and videos on Facebook show Harrigan in an ICE enforcement and removal operation vest. One video appears to show Harrigan detaining a man outside of the Brewster police station. Pereira said she is looking for the son of a man detained by ICE.
Felipe was taken on Sunday morning, and then his son is young and just arrived in a refugee program. And Felipe was the only other person that he knew, and that man took him away, and now we don't know where this young man disappeared to. I need you to help me to find him. I need you to help me to find the both of them.
The residents who defended Harrigan did not deny he worked for ICE. Instead, they said it was no one else's business what a man did for work. That's what local resident Kate Bellatoni told the school board.
The trustee has a job. He has a boss. He pays the same high taxes we all do. He needs to support his family. Therefore, he needs to work. I am proud to stand by this trustee, and I know a majority of Mayapak is too.
School board member Tanner McCracken also spoke in support of Harrigan. He said he thinks his colleague is doing good work and that the residents of Mayapak support him.
He's a good man, and what he does for his job is to keep our community safe. We've gotten coffee through the years, we've talked. What he does, a lot of folks wouldn't do that type of work, but he does it to keep us safe. So they were in huge support. Obviously, there were people here protesting him, asking to resign. I have gone public and said that I believe it is ridiculous to ask a board member to resign their position because of their job occupation.
The board stated they did not plan to remove Harrigan. As Harrigan left the meeting, he said he will not step down.
Do you have 2 minutes to talk?
I gotta run everything through headquarters.
Okay.
If I say anything.
Okay. You're
I'm not resigning.
No, I know.
Yeah, so that's all I would say.
Okay.
For the New York Public News Network, I'm Elias Guerra.
Thank you, Elias, for that story, and thank you to the New York Public News Network for all of those reports. Still to come on the local edition, what's the holdup to federal approval of Pennsylvania's broadband expansion project? Spotlight PA says it's federal officials. Plus, what's being done to keep children away from tobacco? Stay with us.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
If the U.S. and now also allies of the U.S. are stopping these ghost ships, what's going to happen? So the question of how these governments of Iran and Russia are going to survive.
I'm Rachel Abrams. That's Today on the Daily from the New York Times.
I'm Maria Hinojosa, this week on Latino USA. What does recovery look like
a year after the devastating fires in Los Angeles. Who gets to rebuild? Who leaves? That's this week on Latino USA. Thursday afternoon at 2 on Radio Catskill.
This week in This American Life, 911 calls about ICE agents from around the country.
I've got two vehicles that are in Border Patrol and they're following me. And I'm a U.S. citizen. And there's actually four of them trying to ram into my car. Can you please send someone ASAP?
They're calls from emergency rooms, business owners, and immigration agents themselves.
I'm a Border Patrol agent. They stole my uniform.
That's this week.
This American Life, Saturday night at 6 on Radio Catskill.
I'm Jason Dole. It's the local edition. Getting internet access has been a major issue for rural communities, and we here at Radio Catskill, we've been closely watching efforts to do just that in our listening area. You may remember me reporting here that Pennsylvania was ready to invest heavily in broadband connectivity with funds from the federal government, something that would greatly help rural Northeast PA. But the effort has stalled. Spotlight PA reports that hundreds of millions of dollars to expand broadband access in Pennsylvania is still on hold after federal officials failed to meet their self-imposed early December deadline to review the Commonwealth's plan for spending the money. Tim Bruno spoke with Charlotte Keith, investigative reporter with Spotlight PA, this morning on Radio Catskill.
This is all to do with this big pot of federal broadband funding. And in Pennsylvania right now, things are kind of on hold because the state submitted its spending plan to the federal government in early September, and it's still waiting for that to be approved. Until that happens, you know, things can't really get underway. The contracts can't be finalized with the companies who will actually be doing this work. They can't begin construction. There's also actually another layer of federal approval that Pennsylvania will need to get, aside from the one that we discussed in this story. And this delay is really notable because the Trump administration has really emphasized that they want to move very quickly on getting this broadband funding out. And the federal agency in charge of reviewing these plans pledged to get that done within 90 days of states submitting them. But in Pennsylvania's case, that hasn't happened yet. It's been more than 120 days now, and the state is still waiting.
They missed that 90-day review deadline by weeks. What explanation, if any, have they offered to Pennsylvania or other states that are still waiting?
Yeah, I mean, it's worth noting, you know, most states have been approved by this point. Pennsylvania is one of about 10 states that are still waiting, and some of those, they had their own issues. They had to get extensions. But the cause of the delay for Pennsylvania, it's kind of unclear. You know, there have been reports about the federal agency that's looking at these plans, kind of going back and asking states to change very specific things to bring costs down. We don't know if that's been happening to Pennsylvania. I mean, the other thing is just that it is a very ambitious deadline. And it's worth noting that this 90 days we're talking about, it's not, you know, from federal law. It's really just self-imposed by the Trump administration kind of to signal their commitment to getting this done fast.
Let's talk about the impact on the ground. What does this holdup mean right now for Pennsylvania communities that still don't have reliable high-speed internet?
Yeah, well, it's probably only, you know, a temporary holdup, but it's coming on top of what has already been quite a tumultuous time for this broadband funding. The Trump administration over the summer asked states to redo their spending plans and grant applications on a very tight 90-day deadline. And after that happened, you know, state officials joked that calling that work a sprint would be a kind way to describe it. So this all goes back to 2021 when Congress passed this bipartisan infrastructure bill to approve all this funding. And it's been sort of a long process to get to this point. Trump administration officials have been very critical of the pace of progress under the Biden administration. And so that's part of why, you know, they're saying things really need to move fast. But for now in Pennsylvania, it's been a bit, you know, kind of hurry up and wait.
President Trump and his administration rewrote the rules for this program after he took office. What were some of the significant changes and how did they reshape Pennsylvania's broadband plan?
Yeah, so one of the big focuses was to bring the costs down. So Pennsylvania will actually not end up spending its full original $1.1 billion allocation. It will be spending about $790 million. And that's for a number of reasons, but partly because the rules emphasize spending less on fiber optic broadband and more on technologies like satellite and wireless internet. And so Pennsylvania has, you know, both of those in its plan. It's still going to be spending most of the money on fiber broadband. But the rules did kind of open the door for those technologies to be included more.
We're in a rural area here. It seems as if fiber might be more reliable than a shift to satellite and wireless internet connection. Is that a controversial thing, especially in rural areas, for rural areas?
That's actually one of the main objections that experts raised when the rule changes were coming down. That, you know, satellite and wireless, the upfront cost to install them is lower generally than fiber, which can be very expensive. But they're kind of less of a long-term investment. So experts told us that, okay, yes, those technologies, they can meet the minimum speed requirements for this program, but are they going to be the technologies that we're able to rely on for the speeds we need, you know, 10 years from now?
Your reporting indicates that Pennsylvania will expect to spend far less than its full $1.1 billion allocation. Why is that, and what happens with any unused money?
So it's partly because of the rule changes. It's partly because basically more areas now have broadband than they did when the infrastructure law was first passed. So fewer places need this money. What happens to the leftover money is still kind of up in the air. At the end of last year, the president signed this executive order tying the state of that funding to a review of state laws on artificial intelligence. And so it seems that if there are states whose regulations on AI are deemed overly burdensome, they could lose that money. It's really not clear yet what that will look like or what that could mean for Pennsylvania. But obviously, there's a lot of money at stake there. And the state would probably much rather have that to be able to use for other broadband purposes.
Yes, and NTIA has warned that it could reject grants it considers, quote, excessive. That creates so much uncertainty for states trying to plan long-term infrastructure projects, and it seems as if Pennsylvania's been trying to plan broadband access for a long time. Meanwhile, people are still waiting. Do you think that there's a realistic timeline that this is going to happen sooner rather than later?
I mean, it's certainly one of those things that is a really big disconnect between, you know, what it feels like for people who are waiting for this, who, you know, need this in their day-to-day lives, and what's actually quite a complex administrative task to figure out which are the areas that should get this and how to make that happen the best way. Certainly, once Pennsylvania's plan is approved, that is a huge step forward. And, you know, that will mean that then a lot of more specific things can start to be done. And once the grants go out, the companies have, you know, a time frame of several years when they have to commit to providing that service by. So definitely this plan that is still waiting to be approved, you know, that would be a really big step forward.
That's Charlotte Keith, investigative reporter for Spotlight PA. You can read her reporting about broadband expansion on hold in Pennsylvania as feds miss their self-imposed deadline. That's at spotlightpa.org. Charlotte, thank you so much.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Tim Bruno. Finally, tonight on the Local Edition, are states doing enough to keep kids away from tobacco products? Advocates say no, and they say that we're at risk of losing the progress that's already been made on this issue. Radio Catskills' Patricio Rubio spoke with Brian King from the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids.
As the state legislatures open their 2026 seasons, a new national report is warning that decades of progress in reducing tobacco use could stall or even reverse unless states take action. The report calls on states to significantly increase tobacco taxes, saying it's one of the most effective ways to reduce smoking, protect kids, save lives, and raise billions of dollars to fund prevention and other critical public health programs. That warning comes as federal health funding faces deep cuts, including efforts to eliminate the CDC's Office on Smoking and Health, leaving states with more responsibility and fewer resources. Joining us now is Brian King, Executive Vice President for U.S. Programs at the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids. Brian, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, welcome. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yes. So why is this important? Right as the state legislatures are starting to convene, why is this so critical for tobacco policy?
Tobacco continues to be the leading cause of preventable disease and death in this country. We have 500,000 Americans that continue to die from smoking alone each year. And for every person who's dying, we have 30 more living with smoking-related disease and death. And so this issue is not solved, and it's critically important that as legislators go back into session, that they prioritize effort to help prevent what is the leading cause of preventable disease and death. And also importantly, identifying revenue streams that can be used to fund public health policies, which is a no-brainer when it comes to tobacco use. We know increasing price is a very effective policy to help save lives, but also to raise revenue streams for governments.
Right. Your report argues that the tobacco taxes are a win-win. When you go further into that, you know, what do you mean by that? A win-win?
We know that increasing price is the single most effective intervention for reducing consumption of tobacco products. And so it's no coincidence that the states with the highest taxes have the lowest prevalence of use. And so increasing price is a really effective strategy as part of a comprehensive approach. But we also know that in addition to that important health benefit, they're also a guaranteed revenue stream for funding public health-related initiatives as well as other initiatives. And just to give some examples, even raising the tax on cigarette packs by $1.50 will prevent in a given state, either Pennsylvania or New York, thousands of kids from starting to smoke. It would help promote tens of thousands of adults to quit smoking, and it would raise hundreds of million dollars in revenue in just the first year alone, which again, those dollars can be used to help promote critical infrastructure for public health, including tobacco control.
Yeah. And let's talk about those kids. The report says more than 200,000 kids could be prevented from becoming smokers in the first place. That sounds is a large number. And how significant is that to public health in terms of, in long term and short term?
Yeah, and that national estimate of 200,000 would be monumental if all states were to increase by $1.50 the cigarette tax. Ultimately, we know that most adult tobacco users begin before the age of 18, and the vast majority, nearly 99%, begin before the age of 25. And so that's a really critical window. If we can prevent kids from starting altogether, we can prevent them from a lifetime of nicotine addiction. Good news is that tobacco use rates among kids are now at a 25-year low, but there's still more work to do. We have over 2 million kids nationally that are continuing to use these products, including e-cigarettes, nicotine pouches, cigarettes, and others. And so it's really important that we redouble our efforts now more than ever.
Yeah. Now, how do tobacco taxes affect state Medicaid spending?
We do know that a sizable portion of dollars that are spent on healthcare in this country are for smoking-related disease, and a sizable portion of that is paid for by Medicaid and other government services. Presently, over $600 billion is spent in this country on direct healthcare costs and lost productivity from cigarette smoking. And so regardless of the state, if you were to increase the price of these products, it would certainly have a beneficial effect in terms of saving lives, but also preventing those sizable healthcare costs, much of which is borne by the taxpayers for smoking-related disease and death paid by Medicare, Medicaid, and others.
Yeah. Are there any examples of states that invested more in prevention and saw better results?
And so when you look at some of the front runners, California has been at the forefront of tobacco prevention and control for many years, including implementing interventions like price increases, smoke-free policies, cessation resource access, mass reach health communication campaigns, educating people about the risks of these products. And that comprehensive approach is key. It's no coincidence that they have among the lowest levels of smoking nationally and other tobacco use. Similarly, New York has a strong record there as well, but there's still more opportunity regardless of the state. We know what works. We just got to implement those strategies, and we need to make sure that there's continued revenue streams to help uphold them, particularly at a time when we are seeing decimation of federal infrastructure. It's now becoming increasingly important for states to step in.
So you sort of mentioned it already, but what happens if states don't act, and what is the risk if things stay the way they are?
It's a health risk and it's a financial risk. And so from the health risk, we've got nearly 500,000 Americans that continue to die from smoking each year. We've got nearly 30 million adults in this country that are still smoking. And we know that smoking harms nearly every organ of the body and is a completely preventable health risk. And so it certainly would be a health benefit to implement these policies. And if we don't, it could potentially reverse the decades of progress we've made in reducing smoking. And of course, there's also that financial incentive incentive as well, that if we don't take action, there's going to continue to be hundreds of billions of dollars spent in this country each year for healthcare costs and also lost productivity from smoking-related disease and death. Mm.
If lawmakers are listening right now and could take just one step this session, well, what would you want it to be?
Increase the price of cigarettes. We know from the available evidence that it's the most effective strategy, and even a $1.50 increase in the tax per cigarette pack would have a monumental effect in terms of saving lives, but also nearly a $6 billion revenue stream nationally if all states were to take that action in just the first year alone. So we know it works. We've just got to implement it, and it takes everyone, including legislators, to get the wheels turning on that front.
Yeah, and I can see why you said in the report it's a win-win. For both sides. Yep. One question I had before we go, the report also found that long-term healthcare savings, if this goes through, how fast or where do those savings show up first?
We'd see them across the board. We know that healthcare costs are borne in a variety of ways, but it would be particularly impactful for those spending the most. And right now, we do know that government-subsidized services, including Medicaid at the state and federal level, and also Medicare, are borne a sizable portion of those dollars. And so we'd expect the savings to be particularly prominent in those areas, and we would expect that savings to be immediate. If all states were to increase the price to $1.50 per pack on tax, we'd see $6 billion in just the first year alone in revenue streams. And so it would be immediate. And those who would benefit the most would be state governments, who would be averting the costs related to smoking-related disease, but importantly, also putting dollars into their coffers to spend on other things, including public health and other tobacco control initiatives.
Yeah. So Brian, before we go, is there anything else we have not touched on you want folks to know?
If they want to learn more information about the report, they can go to tobaccofreekids.org, including estimates by state, as well as other statistics and useful information around tobacco prevention and control.
That's Brian King with the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids, discussing a new report urging states to increase tobacco taxes and invest in prevention to protect public health and save lives. You can find the full report at tobaccofreekids.org, and also you can find it on our website at wjffradio.org. Brian, again, thank you so much for this. I do really appreciate it.
Thank you, Patricio. Well, that's it for the local edition. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Jason Dole. Again, I hope you're doing all right after the snowstorm. I hope you're warm. I hope you're safe. A couple of things that I want to mention. If you've still got some shoveling to do, like I know I sure do, please take it easy. Every winter, people do get back injuries. People do have heart attacks just from shoveling. So pace yourself. Take frequent breaks. Don't just keep going if you feel exhausted. And I just want to mention, multiple folks I know who grew up around here are referring to this winter as an old school winter. And driving around Liberty and Monticello yesterday and today, I have to say it really reminds me of what most of the winters look like when I was a little kid growing up here in the 80s. Many winters, we just don't get as much snow as they forecast for us up here. This winter, the trend has been that we've been getting as much, if not more, snow than is forecast. So something that you might not be used to in recent years is after a big storm like this, there are big snow banks everywhere. So please be careful around intersections when pulling in or out of businesses. Visibility has been impacted by how much snow's been piled up. Sometimes it's hard to see the traffic coming. So drive cautiously around, especially towns and villages when you're in town, because it could be a little bit harder to see because of snow, let alone what the snow does to the roads itself. Coming up at 7 o'clock, we've got 2 hours of great music with Mr. Kusar Grace on the Music Emporium. But before that, more news on the way from The Daily. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Tavern on Main, where modern American cuisine meets classic favorites. Dinner, weekend brunch, craft cocktails, and warm hospitality on Main Street in Jeffersonville. More at tavernonmainny.com.
So here's the deal. Public radio is now operating without federal funding, and your support matters more than ever. One way to help is to donate that car, truck, or old motorcycle in your driveway. You'll clear out some space and help keep trusted news coverage alive in your community. The process? Simple. Free, even tax deductible. Just head to this station's website and help us keep this work going together.
Donate your car, boat, or motorcycle at wjffradio.org.
Every weekday morning at 9, NewsHour from the BBC brings you the most important international news stories. NewsHour helps you understand a complex world. Stay informed with NewsHour from the BBC, weekday mornings at 9 on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville. Radio.